Good afternoon. So last time, we started by talking about what an operating system is. We had these sort of big things that OSs did of abstracting and sharing sort of common resources. And we had sort of another way of looking at things that OSs provided this sort of virtual machine, by which I didn't mean something like VirtualBox or VMware. I meant something that, is a fake machine that programs are written for. In contrast to a physical, real piece of hardware that you might write programs for. And the OS's job in this model was translating from this fake machine interface to the physical machine interface. We started looking at the implementation of sort of the key OS abstraction of processes. We mentioned that processes were sort of threads plus an address space, plus usually files. And sort of a key thing in implementing a key aspect of processes, which is that different processes kind of don't interfere with each other, that when you get a thread, which we mentioned was kind of a virtual CPU, virtual processor, that, that's independent from the other virtual processors on the system, the other threads. And we needed some way of making that actually true. And typically, we have these two coupled hardware mechanisms that OSs use to do this. So one is that hardware typically has two modes it can operate in, the physical processors. They can be in kernel mode, in which case sensitive operations are allowed, or in user mode, in which case they are not. And we could run the OS code in kernel mode because we want the OS code to do sensitive operations like, changing address spaces, accessing things for other programs, accessing devices, and configuring exceptions to be limited to the OS, and dot programs, can do that only by asking the OS to do it on their behalf. And I'll mention later that perhaps to make it easier or harder to understand, there's something called a kernel, which is a part of the OS, which is basically the part of the OS that runs in kernel mode and generally is loaded all the time. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about how that works. So if kernel mode is where we can do these sensitive operations, like changing what memory your program can access, accessing devices to actually do I/O, we need some way of, entering and leaving kernel mode. And sort of the primary mechanism for that is this thing known as exceptions, which is a hardware way of jumping to OS code. And there's a lot of ways this can happen. This can be deliberately triggered, which we'll talk about a bunch today. It can be from external devices like key presses, network input, that these external devices will give some signal to the processor saying there's something you need to do, and the processor is going to have the OS do it by using this exception mechanism to run the OS. And also from error. So when the processor doesn't know what to do, if a program does something like divide by zero and the processor can't decide what to do, it's going to ask the OS, hey, what do you want to do, by jumping to it and letting it handle that, for example, by killing the program and running some other program. And one particular type of exception we're going to be particularly concerned with to start out is system call. So system call is a name we give for deliberately triggered exceptions that programs use to request the OS do something. And the program can't make just a normal function call because it wants that this operation to be done with the extra privileges that kernel mode allows. And we're going to look in particular about how system calls look in XV6 as our sort of first big topic for today. So before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so first I'm going to do some logistical things. So when I talked about logistics last time, I mentioned that we're going to have some quizzes. I'll show you what that quiz system looks like. So this is our quiz webpage. You can see we have the quizzes open several hours after lecture. It's several hours, so if we get to a different amount of material than I planned for, I can change the quiz so we don't ask you about things we haven't covered. It closes then. There's no time limit. It's open book, open notes, open internet, as we discussed earlier. And here I have just a demo of the quiz system. So when you go quiz site, you choose the quiz you want to do. We'll ask you to confirm, and you'll be able to change your answers. So there could be select all that apply questions, one works where you fill in the blank, and single select answers. And when you select an answer in any of these, the box will change to green. It will flash, as you may or may not see, yellow while it's sending the answer to the server. If it stays yellow, your answer is not recorded. There's some sort of network problem, or you got logged out of NetBadge or similar. Or in the case of if you're typing in a box, the answer won't be recorded until you shift your focus somewhere else. There's a comment box below each question. This is where you should put anything like the question's ambiguous or none of the answers make sense, any sorts of those concerns. We will eventually have the TAs read all the comments and adjust scores accordingly. And so this is where you deal with, there's something wrong with the question. We can give you credit if you write a comment. If you don't, we don't know what you were thinking. We can't really do anything about that. And that's how you should deal with things like you think the question's unclear or has a mistake. Use the comments field to do that. So that's what it's there for. And after the quiz closes, it will automatically be graded based on a key we have. So here's an example of what it might look like. These mark answers that were correct. These percentages are the percentage of students that selected those answers. And you can see for fill in the blank, we have the key here and so on. When you type comments, eventually a TA will get to it. And when they do so, you may see some feedback below your comment. And when that happens, the score may be adjusted. But immediately after the quiz closes, we probably will not have looked at your comments. That will probably take like a week. So please wait to complain about that until after, some time has passed. So there's a question in do you put relevant assumptions? We have an answering question in the comments as well. So you should put any information you think would affect whether your answer is correct or not. Okay, and someone would like to point out that the button for, yes, the button for this check marks is the line, which is meant to be a convenience feature, but I guess that could have confused people. And I would mention that you don't have to answer the quiz in one sitting, so you can always go back and reload it to see what answers you have recorded. And if you're concerned that you might have had some sort of network problem, this is the way to see, you know, did my answer, did my comment make it through? And in the event of, like, weird things happening, we do have, like, a log of answers that were submitted, but, you know, hopefully things are set up so you can usually make sure the correct answer is recorded. You can always change your answers up until the closing time. Also. Okay, so questions about the quiz system. Okay, so as I alluded to when going over things we covered before, we're going to look at XV6, which follows this classic Unix design. Before I go into that late question, the question is, will the quizzes be curved if everyone does really bad on one of the quizzes? I intend to do any sort of adjustments to what counts as a A, B, C, D, and so on at the end of the semester, rather than trying to adjust the assignments as they come through. As is documented on the grading policies page for this course, pull it up so I get the exact quote. Two quizzes will be dropped for everyone. Okay, so the classic Unix design, we have sort of our applications, and sort of the diagrams we've shown before are the applications sit atop the OS. And I talked about system calls as being how you request things from the OS. But usually in this sort of Unix design, that's what Linux uses, it's what XV6 uses. And turns out it's also very similar to Windows. You don't actually directly make system calls. You instead call standard library functions. And there's some standard libraries, also some standard utility programs that, you know, then make system calls on your behalf. And some people will tell you, well, all this stuff, these standard libraries, the standard utility programs, those are the OS collectively. Because, you know, printf, in that case, you think is part of the OS, even though it's not the thing that enters this special mode that actually is able to do the showing things on the screen. It actually is a layer above the thing which does that. And some people would say only this kernel mode stuff is the OS. And the argument for that is that, well, there's a standard library that comes with, say, my Linux system, but I could make another one and use the same kernel stuff. And also, for the purpose of speaking about how do we actually, like, display things on the screen, how do we share the CPU between multiple programs, and questions like that, this is the part which really matters, and this is where we're going to be focusing our attention. And we're going to be looking at XV6, that's sort of our teaching operating system that we're going to have some assignments to modify. And XV6, well, regardless of what part of it you say is the OS, it comes with these components. So it both has sort of a standard library for writing applications and some standard programs, as well as a kernel. And as I mentioned earlier, the kernel, this is the stuff that runs in kernel mode that's generally always loaded. And besides sort of pointing out the ambiguity of what's called the OS, a big reason I'm pointing this out is to make it clear that, you know, when you ask to print something to the screen, that makes a system call, but that's not the system call. There's some other code that still runs in user mode that's loaded with your application because it's a standard library. So we're going to work with XV6, has a Unix-like kernel, which implements a very small set of system calls. Now, when you actually look at the set of system calls, it's like maybe 20. But for a Unix-like OS that is very small, Linux has like a couple hundred. And they're somewhat less featureful than the system calls you'd find on a Unix-like OS. For example, there's no notion of an exit status. It has a user space library, like I mentioned, so it has some standard tools like a printf that aren't implemented directly with the system call, but make system calls. And some user space programs, so it has a shell, a command line, things like ls, makedir, echo to print things to the screen, cat to output a file, and also some programs for testing the kernel that the people who wrote XV6 needed so they know that it kind of works. So XV6, since we have this user space library, you can write programs kind of like the ones you're used to if you remember writing things in C. So here's XV6's echo.c. So echo is a program which you can run like, you know, from your terminal, the dollar sign represents a terminal prompt. If you type echo foo bar, it will print out foo bar. So it just prints out the arguments. So the way this works is that it takes in the arguments, argc and argv, which you may or may not remember from 2150. It iterates through the arguments starting with index 1. Why index 1? Because if you remember vaguely how arguments were passed in C in 2150, echo is argv0, and the other arguments would be 1 and 2 and so on. And it prints a format with two strings, with the argument and possibly a space or a new line. Now you might say, wait a moment, what is this here? What's this? Why is there a 1 to printf? So XV6, printf's a bit different. So the printf takes, this is the file descriptor. We'll talk more about what those are to write to. And 1 is standard out. 2 is standard error. And 0 would be standard in, which you can't write to. So another thing you might notice about this, which is maybe a bit weird if you remember how to write things in C, is that we have this explicit call to exit, which takes no arguments. And you might say, well, couldn't we have just done return 0? And the answer is not really. So exit, you need to explicitly exit. If you return 0, this will segfault. So it exits the program, but it segfaults because XV6 doesn't have code that called main that you can return to. On a typical Linux OS, the reason why returning 0 for main works is that basically there's some hidden code that is part of the standard library which calls main that main can return to. In XV6, you know, Linux, in XV6, main is called directly from the kernel. It's actually where the program starts, so there's nothing to return to. So there's a question, is the reason you can't return zero because there's no exit status. So, whether or not there's an exit status isn't the main problem. The main problem is that there's no code which called main to return to. On Linux, there's code that's part of the standard library which called main, so returning goes somewhere. Here, there's not actually anything, any return address on the stack. But in Linux, when your main starts, actually some code ran before and put a pushed a return address on the stack, so returning will work. Does that answer the question? So I guess one way that might explain it better is that, you know, this is happening not because we're removing an exit status, but because the way XV6 starts programs is simpler than you see in an OS like Linux. Okay, and so for your first assignment, which is next week, you're going to use XV6, and I should show you. So when you download and get XV6, you'll get something that looks kind of like this in a directory. You'll run make to compile it. You might need to change the make file a bit if you want to try to do this natively on Mac OS X, which we don't officially support just because I can't test it, but you can probably get working based on historical experience. And then we can run it with a command like make umu nux. So this is going to be something we run in a kind of virtual machine. So QMUs are hardware virtual machine. It's an emulator for x86 in the mode we're using it. It can also support a bunch of other things. I'm going to run the -nox. X is the windowing system on Unix. So I'm just going to run this in my terminal. And it compiles things, and then you can see that it boots XV6, and these are some messages that XV6 prints up on boot. The stuff up here is the BIOS that QEMU supplies, so the startup software that the emulated hardware has. And now this is XV6 booting. These are messages which are printed out in the boot code, and it runs a shell. And you can see I mentioned there's an LS. So here's my file listing. Most of the utilities you'll see in XV6 are way less featureful than the ones you're probably used to in other OSs. So here it just prints out numbers, one of which is the size, and I don't actually remember what the others are. Could check the source code for that. And we can see we have, for example, the echo program. So I can run that by running echo foobar and so on. So there's a question, what do the dot and dot dot mean? On Unix, dot is the current directory and dot dot is the parent directory. So these are both in this case because our current directory is actually slash the root directory. They both are other name pointers to the root directory. So typically when you run LS on a Unix-like system, these entries are not shown, but this version of LS is very simple, so it doesn't try to strip anything like that out. And within XV6, there's a shutdown program. And when I run that, it stops QEMU. There's also other ways of stopping it, which we mention in the assignment. Right now. So that's running it. Just so you know kind of what it looks like. There's also a graphical mode, which I won't demonstrate, which just shows that terminal in a new window. I'm not going to demonstrate it primarily because I'm not set up to screen share that. So that's XV6 briefly. And you're going to, for the first assignment, add some features to the XV6 kernel and write a program that you can run from that shell to test it. So we have this echo program here, And this echo program calls printf. And printf needs to make some system calls in order for something to actually be output to the screen. And there's a particular system call it makes, which is going to be called write. That's the name of the system call. And we're going to talk about how that works in XV6. And there's a lot of steps. So we're going to go through this, but I'm going to start with this high-level diagram. And part of these steps are going to happen in user mode. So this is not part of the kernel. So we have this user program, which is going to call a write function. And you might say, wait a moment, my program that I just showed you, the print echo program, it didn't call write, it called printf. So there's a function call in that case to printf, and printf ends up calling a write function. And this write function is what we'll call a system call wrapper. It's a part of the library that XV6 provides for applications whose only purpose is to make a system call. So a system call, is going to be similar to a function call, but it's not going to use the same instructions because a normal call is not going to cause an exception, and that's what we want to do. We want to switch to kernel mode. So it's going to use a special instruction. The one that XV6 has chosen for this is this instruction int$64, which is just an instruction that deliberately triggers an exception. And when this instruction is run, the hardware is going to look up where to jump to in the OS in something called that, x86 calls. You might see some other names for it, an interrupt table. And the hardware is going to call an assembly function that's in the XV6 source code called vector64. The reason it's called vector64 is that this instruction is going to trigger exception with ID 64, and XV6 has generated a different one of these functions for each different type of exception that could be triggered. And something that the X86 hardware does that it didn't have to do is that as part of making this jump, it actually switches stacks. So the stack that's active in user mode and the stack that's active in kernel mode will be different. This is just something the hardware implements to try to make it easier for operating systems. But if it didn't, the operating system could have this function switch stacks if it wanted to. So this is on a different stack. We have this assembly function. And what this assembly function does is it saves the registers. Why does it do that? Because we don't want to have things that the kernel code does interfere with the user code. And it calls some functions that are internal to XV6, which eventually makes its way to a function in XV6 called syswrite, which implements the actual write operation. So there's this whole lot of indirection here. We'll talk about sort of what's going on there. But the sort of big picture and why wouldn't this function, why did XV6 decide to have all these extra steps instead of going here? Or that there's a bunch of work that's going to be common for every type of exception that XV6 wanted to centralize, of like saving and restoring the registers, handling cases where we need to context switch or things like that. That's going to be in these common functions here. So that's why they chose not to just direct it. So there's a question, what does this color coding mean? So the part I have in this purple here, this is the part that executes in user mode. This part here that's in yellow is the part that executes in kernel mode. Other questions about this sort of high-level picture? So there's a question of what programs are in each of these commands. So this here is any program we're running, we run that does output. Output and its libraries is represented by this user program box. So this process is going to happen for Echo, for the shell, any program we run on XV6, this is how it's going to output things at all. And then there's a question, what does HW mean? HW is hardware. There's another question of, if the syscall was not right, would the overall picture still be the same? Yes, basically you just change right and this for something else, and there'd be some minor differences in details that don't really show up here. There's a question, someone's reading this carefully and noticing that I wrote a note here that syswrite read the args from the user stack. You're saying, how can it do that if we switch stacks? Well, we're going to, the old stack pointer will be saved somewhere, and that's how it's going to do that, as you will see. Now, there's a good question. All this yellow code here, all this stuff that runs in kernel mode, what program is it in? So this is in the program we call the kernel. This is something that's loaded at boot. That isn't the part of anything we'd run from the shell. It's just loaded at boot. It's sort of the core part of the OS that's loaded all the time. And we'll see, like, so in the XV6 source code, there's some source files like echo.c that just become an independent program. And there's a bunch of source files that become just the kernel, which is basically the first thing that loads, which is a big program with, you know, source code from lots of files in it. That answer everyone's questions about this high-level picture. Okay. So let's look at our write system call. So I mentioned that typically we see this called from the library, but we could write a program, and here's my example program that I could at compile for XV6 that uses the write system call apparently directly. So we're going to call this write function, which is going to kind of stand in for the system call. And we're going to provide the arguments the kernel is going to expect for the system call. And the arguments that XV6 expects for the system call are something known as a file descriptor. And I mentioned when I talked about printf that one is standard out, a string to write, and the length of the string. So those are our three arguments. And we're calling this apparently normal C function. But a normal C function call is not a way to cause an exception. So, you know, this C code isn't going to do that. And there's no actual way of writing in normal C code, make an exception and run the kernel. So XV6's solution is that they write these little C functions that kind of do the extra work to cause an exception. And in the XV6 source code, this is in an assembly file called usys.s. And I'm showing you the assembly here after some macro, after some like pound defines happen. This is the assembly that exists for to implement the write function in assembly. So what this does is it eventually uses this special instruction, which just tsyscall is the number 64 because of these constants that are defined. And this is what actually triggers the exception and enters that kernel code that was preloaded. So another thing you might notice that this function does is that it sets EAX to this constant syswrite. So XV6 defines a constant to identify each different kind of system call. And the way they tell which system call is being made is by looking for this constant in the register EAX. This is what XP6 chose to do. They could have used a different way of distinguishing between the system calls, but they used this mechanism, which is actually very common. It's also what Linux uses, for example. And for the other arguments, they have to be passed to the kernel, and the decision that XP6 made is that XP6 is going to expect to find them on the stack, which is the same as the 32-bit x86 calling convention. So later on, we're going to see code which is going to retrieve those arguments, but it turns out in XP6, that's actually several steps later. So there's a question I got from the chat, which is, what happens if the length specified here, this 14, is longer than the actual string? We'll look at that again when we talk about how these arguments are going to be retrieved. So we haven't gotten there yet, gotten to actually looking at the arguments yet. So there's a question, when is this sys write? So in this syscall.h, there's a number defined for each different kind of system call. So there's a sysread, there's like a sysshutdown, there's all these different system calls, read, write, shutdown, exit, and there's a different number defined for each of them. And the purpose of the number is just to make it so later on we can tell, did you call write or did you call shutdown or exit? Because we're going to have, you know, a very similar function for exit and shutdown, etc. So we're going to have basically the same function. So when this exception happens, XP6 needs a way of knowing which of those functions did you call. It's going to look at the constant that was moved into EAX to figure that out. And then there's a question, what's this tsys call? So it's the constant 64. That's literally what it is. And as for why was 64 chosen, that's basically an arbitrary choice because there are different kinds of exceptions you can trigger with this instruction. So XP6 arbitrarily chose, will trigger the kind with number 64 with this instruction. And that will come up when we look at how does XP6 set up the code it wants to run in response to this exception. It needs to set up a different piece of code depending on what number would go here. Okay, and one more question I haven't handled. How does this work with multiple cores? So for system calls, basically the way it works is that the system call will be handled on the same core that triggered it. So there's no worrying about other cores. Other cores will operate independently and not notice that this is going on. Okay. So we see the process of triggering an exception. And I mentioned that that exception is going to cause the hardware to look up a place to jump to in the OS. And to make that work on boot, some code in the OS is going to have to have set up a table that gives the location to jump to. And the way this works in XP6 is that that table is set up on boot, and this is sort of the code snippet which does it. So this LIDT function is just a function which wraps the LIDT instruction, which is the set load interrupt descriptor table instruction. So this is says, this is where the table of code to run when an exception happens is. And this setgate here, this is a macro that just sets an entry in that table. So basically on boot, by which I mean on startup, XP6 runs this code to run a special instruction to tell the hardware, hey, this is where you find the locations to go to when an exception happens. and it sets an entry in that table of places to go to have an entry for system calls in particular. And each of those entries has a bit of extra metadata that isn't particularly important, but the most important information is that it has a pointer to the function to run. And in this case, that's gotten from this array of function pointers, and this is going to point to a function called vector64. So there's some other information here. The only important piece of information is that this field here is saying, hey, this is something I'm expecting the user to trigger deliberately. Please make sure that that's going to work hardware. If the XV6 didn't do this, it would trigger a different kind of exception instead. And this last part here, which is basically boilerplate, is saying, hey, I would like you to make sure this exception runs in kernel mode. X86 supports having these exception handlers not do that, though that's not a feature that I know any OS which uses. And we also have this setting here about whether you want to disable other interrupts, which is turned off. Meaning that if a key press happens during a system call, XV6 has chosen that it will handle the key press during the system call. If this was set to zero, that would not be true. But the most important thing is that we're telling the hardware, hey, here's where the stuff that handles exceptions is, and for system calls, I want you to call this function here, which is going to be a pointer to the function vector64 we'll look at later. Questions? Yes. Okay. So we set up this pointer, which points to this vector64 function, and there's an assembly file that's defined in called vectors.s. And what it does is it pushes two numbers onto the stack, jumps to this other assembly function that eventually calls this C function called trap. So if you're thinking about this table here, this might seem a little silly because it turns out that every single different kind of exception goes to a function that looks like this, that goes to this all traps function that calls this C function called trap. So even though the hardware will run a different function for every kind of exception, XV6 has chosen to write a function that just calls the single function. XV6 has decided, yeah, that hardware feature wasn't actually that useful. All I want to do is store a number and call a single function. Now, there's some important work which is going to be done here, and the big thing that happens here is that this code here is going to save any registers, and also copy the old stack pointer. And that's going to be what forms the argument to this trap function called trap frame. So trap frame is going to be a struct containing all the registers before the exception. Before the exception plus the type of exception. So there's a good question here. The trap function just allows the program to go back to user code, right? So this trap function here, this is still in the kernel. So the XV6 kernel is written in a combination of assembly and C. And like most OSs, XV6 has tried to not write very much code in assembly. So we have these little bits of assembly, which primarily exist just to call the C code, because they really wanted to write most of the code in C, because that's way more convenient. Does that answer that question? Yeah, so don't be confused about C equals user versus not. We're going to be looking at a lot of C code that runs in kernel mode. And we're going to not actually have very much assembly code in the kernel because we don't need it. So, So there's one question here. So someone was pointing out that, oh, this looks like we're calling vectors of 64, not the function vector 64. So it turns out that vectors here, there's basically an array, vectors, which is initialized to vector 0, comma, vector 1, vector 2, and so on. So this ends up being equal to vector 64. There's some indirection when doing that. There's a question, what is this trap.c do? We're going to look at that next. Okay, so let's do that. So here's our trap.c. So this is a trap function. This is the beginning of that. You see we have this argument trap frame, which is set by the assembly code that we saw earlier. So it contains the type of interrupt, type of exception, and the application registers. And you can see the first thing that trap does is it says, was the type of exception, which is stored in the trapno field, a syscall? And that was recorded by the assembly code that called this from vector 64 and got here. And if so, it's going to do some stuff related to the system call. And we're going to see a lot of use of this thing called myproc. So myproc, this is a function that's kind of like a global variable. We'll talk about how it works later, but basically it retrieves a struct that tells us about the currently running process and that has some useful fields like this killed field was the process killed, and this TF field, which is the saved registers for the process. So we talked about like saving things in a context switch. This is in fact where we're going to save some of those registers. So you can see what we do here is when there's a system call, we check, hey, is this process supposed to be killed? If so, exit and don't do the system call. Otherwise, save the registers, save a copy of the current registers for later. And call this function called syscall, and this is where we're actually going to implement the system call here. And it's going to use these save registers to figure out, oh, what system call were you trying to do? What were the arguments? And so on. And after that finishes, we check whether the process is killed now. For example, maybe it was the exit system call, and then return. And we'll talk about how the return works, but basically we're going to return to the assembly code that called us. That code's going to do the special hardware instruction to go back to user mode. But let's look at this syscall function. So the way this syscall function works here is that it retrieves the system call number. So remember that this was syswrite in the case of our write system call. And it checks that that number is in range. And if it is, it looks up an array of function pointers. That's what this is. Yes, I know the syntax is really weird for that particular system call and calls it. And you might say, wait a moment, it's not calling it with any arguments. We'll look at how it actually gets the arguments later, but we're not going to actually pass the arguments to this syswrite function, but this is going to implement the write system call. And after it calls this function, it stores the return value of the system call in the saved value of EAX. So why this is done is that the code which, you know, code that returns that start run returns to user mode will set EAX to this value. So this is a way that we can communicate the result of the system call back to the program, because after, you know, that exception finishes, it's going to go back to the program after the exception triggering, and now EAX is going to be set this way because we changed the save value to restore. So there's a question going back to our trap function. What do we expect trap to return if my proc isn't killed? It doesn't have a return type. So if you just return from trap, what's going to happen is that the code that's here is going to restore the registers that it previously saved, and then it's going to go back to user mode, back where it was. So there's a question about what this curproc is. So not shown here is that basically this code does curproc equals myproc. So it's just a struct that represents the currently running process. Other questions about this code? Okay. So we have this syswrite function. And the syswrite function, if you remember, we called the system call wrapper, that normal function called write with arguments, you know, the file descriptor, string in the length, and this retrieves them, and there's these utility functions which do it. And what these functions do is that they're going to look at myproc, the saved registers, and the saved stack pointer. So the code that dealt with writing the trap function will have saved the old stack pointer. The hardware will have put it somewhere, and that code will copy it to the trap frame struct. And this arg function here, argfd, argint, argpointer, are going to retrieve that from the stack using that stack pointer, because it's not on our current stack, and copy the arguments to, in this case, np and to this struct file. Is going to do a little lookup. We'll talk about how that works when we talk about how files work. But like for this int, it's going to read the integer argument from the stack and copy it to the local variable n. For this pointer, someone had a question, what if the string was too long? It's going to read the pointer that was on the stack and verify that it has n bytes after it that are readable. And because we're copying things from the stack and we don't actually know that the user called things correctly, each of these things can fail. For example, maybe the stack pointer is invalid, maybe this n is too big, in which case they'll return -1 and we'll return -1 from our system call rather than like segfaulting because we're accessing something invalid. Questions about this idea of how we retrieve arguments? So your question is argfd and these other arg functions use myproc? That global pseudo global variable? Yes. Other questions? So the question, what are these 0, 1, and 2 for? So this is, so remember that it's write FD string size. So we've just numbered these 0, 1, and 2. That's what the 0, 1, and 2 are from. 0 for the file, 1 for the string pointer, 2 for the size. Okay. So after the... the question, why do these functions take void as an argument? This is just say, this just means no arguments. For historical reasons, it can make a difference in C whether you declare things with void with older versions of C, which is why XV6 uses void explicitly. That's just a way of saying no arguments. And after the arguments are retrieved, there's this internal function, which is called, we're not going to go into the details of how that works today. We'll talk about how IO works much later. So after all that's done, the trap function returns, and we have this code I mentioned earlier that restores the registers from the trap frame. And note that this includes this change to the EAX register, because this is what we're going to restore from. And then uses this special instruction IRET, which stands for return from interrupt, to actually go back to the user program. And that completes our cycle. And so have our diagram. So there's a question that what's the point of vectors.s? Like, why did we have this wrapper function here? And also, like, this seems very roundabout. So this 64 is what we used to indicate that it was a system call. And the main purpose of having this vector 64 function is that this is how we save that information so we can use it later in this trap function. And we have just this big one trap function because there's these common tasks we might want to do for all types of exceptions. So XV6 wants to have a single entry point. That's a design decision they made. They could have done something else, but they wanted to have a single place which lets them like always do something on an exception. Like, for example, you can always check, is the process being killed, and should I just ignore the exception, its request, no matter whether the exception happens because of a system call or like a divide by zero, you might want to always run that code. The trap function is a place you can put code like that. But you can consider this vector function a way of kind of like, even though that's what XV6 wants, that's not what the hardware supports, so this particular vector function's a way of bridging between that gap. So the 64 indicated was a system call that was used to figure out which vector function to run. That function also stored that number for later on so we could tell in the trap function after doing things that we're going to do for all types of exceptions that it's a system call. And our system call wrapper, remember that write function call, also stored this system call number, and that's how we knew it was a write instead of like an exit or some other system call we might implement, because they're all going to use the same interrupt type. And we got the arguments from the stack, and if we remember our write function didn't actually do anything explicit with the arguments, but they're on the stack because of how calling a function in 32-bit x86 works in C. So those end up getting read by the kernel because it knows where they are based on you have to call a system call wrapper to put them there.
Okay. So
that I dropped in my place. Oh. So, questions. Now, yes. So, that's how the rank system call works. And the homework that's next week, we're going to have you add two new system calls, which is one reason I went into such detail about how they work. One is going to be write count, and what it's going to need to do is going to return the number of times a write call happened across the entire system, not just in like the current process, across the entire system since everything started. There's going to keep a global counter, and a second call called set write count, which will reset the count that write count returns to a particular number. So your steps are going to be, you know, add a new system call. My recommendation is look at an existing system call. And the write-up, we recommend sysuptime because it's a very simple system call, even simpler than write. Probably much simpler than write. And so you need to add it to all the places. And also create a program that calls it. So something that looks kind of like echo, but calls the write count so you can know it works. And do the same for set write count. So, questions about the high-level homework task? The question is, will this include writing in assembly? You will have to do the necessary work to make sure that there is a system call wrapper for write count and set write count, which will involve creating assembly, but you probably won't think of it as writing assembly because there's basically a macro that you're going to be adding that it's going to, you're going to basically do the same thing that's done for an existing system call. Other questions? Okay. And something that comes up in this is that there's some code that we imitate which uses acquire and release, which is relating to handle multiple cores. You don't need to worry about that because we're not run in single core. Also a question, is there a Piazza for this class? Yes, it is linked off the CoLab. So, with homework stuff, I'm going to briefly talk about another logistics question. Where can we find recordings of lecture? They are linked off the schedule page. Okay. So, I'm going to talk about sort of something I kind of glossed over, which is that we have this separate stack and sort of also how the memory layout works in XV6. So I mentioned earlier that we have address translation, that we have a mapping of the addresses you can access when you're running process A or process B that's set by the OS. And when we change between process A and B, we change this mapping. And one of the features of this mapping is we can set parts of it to only work in kernel mode. And the way XV6 takes advantage of this is that when a program is loaded, it gets loaded into the lower addresses, which are in green on this diagram. And the larger addresses are only marked as accessible to the kernel. And XV6 make sure that these larger addresses are mapped in the same way in every single program. The lower addresses, well, different processes are going to have different stuff loaded, going to have different things here. And in fact, XV6 ends up mapping this in a very static way in that basically, you know, they just map, have this be a one-to-one mapping to the physical addresses. They just set up the mapping so this base address plus 100,000 is physical address 100,000. And we have in this picture our user stack shown here, and the kernel stack that I mentioned is used when we're handling an exception is up here. And XV6 has made a choice that this kernel stack, it allocates, has a different one for each user thread, so which basically maps to each process. And also one extra for switching threads, which we'll talk about when we talk about how we do actual deciding what program to run. And the way this works in the hardware is that x86 has this feature that there's a register to store what stack do I want to use for exceptions, and XV6 makes sure this is set to the currently active kernel stack. Okay, and as I said, XV6 has chosen to do this one per user thread. Okay, so I showed you how write system calls work, and that tells you most of what you'd want to know about sort of the other types of exceptions which happen. So an XV6 has code to handle this, which we can see mostly in the trap function. So XV6 sets all the table entries for all the different types of exceptions to end up calling the trap function in a similar way to how it does it for system calls. It turns out system calls are special, but there's this loop which just basically sets all the other entries, you know, the same as for system calls, but marking it as, you know, not able to be triggered with the int function, with the int instruction. So it all ends up going to the trap function in the same kind of way that happens for system calls. So as an example, let's say we have a program that you're running in XV6, which does something like tries to access invalid memory or divide by zero. It's going to end up calling the trap function because the type of exception, whatever index into the table of types of exceptions, which is what this IDT is, interrupt descriptor table. So a description for each type of interrupt, which is x86's term for exceptions. It's going to call this function, which calls trap, which hopefully answers questions people confused about what this IDT is. So that's going to go to the trap function. And the trap function has this switch statement where it handles things that aren't system calls. And the default case in that, which includes things like divide by zero, it prints something out. Cprintf's a function to print something to the console. And then marks the current program as killed. Something I'd like to note, because it comes up when you're doing assignments, is that it prints out, when it's printing things out, the trap number, so you can look up what kind of exception it is. More featureful S would do this for you, but you can look this up in traps.h. So if you see this trap zero message and you want to know, how did I screw up, you can look that up. Also, we have exceptions from IO. So there's a bunch of entries in cases in the trap function which handle IO in the sense of handling that we got a key press, which are these two, or we got disk input or output finished. And this is where that's handled. This is separate from the system call part. So this is the part after, or separate from the application requesting it. This is where the OS learns that the hardware, you know, did the IO or got something or so on. There's also a timer interrupt. So XV6 doesn't let a program run forever without letting other programs run. And the way it does this is it sets up a timer on startup. And that timer triggers an exception every so many microseconds or milliseconds. And that timer triggers this type of exception. And you can see the code here. We have something that increments a number of ticks and also calls this wake up function. This is to handle sleep calls. So things that say sleep for a certain number of seconds. And we have the second part here, which says, if we're currently running a program and a timer interrupt occurred, yield, and this is switch to another program. So this is how we keep a program that's running an infinite loop. A timer interrupt will happen, and we'll hit this case that, oh, we're running a program right now, and a timer interrupt happened. Let's see if we want to go run another program instead. So that's where that happens. And our next big topic is going to be how, you know, when this happens and we want to run another program, how do we actually switch to another program? So the idea that, you know, an exception is going to happen and we're going to end up running a different program. So how does that work? And conceptually, what we're going to be doing is what we'll call a context switch. That we're going to be saving the old program stuff, its program counter, its registers, other things, and set the new program, the one we're switching to, so in this case from loop to SSH, and jump there. And we call this process a context switch. And we're going to talk about how that works, and the context switch process in XP6 is heavily integrated with how exceptions are handled, which is why we started with talking about how system calls work and how exceptions work. Because it's going to be handled as part of this timer interrupt and also other types of exceptions which would end up running another program. So we have our context, is our save register values and condition codes and program counter, and also some other information like the current address space, which is that mapping. That we mapping from program addresses to machine addresses. So we're going to save all that information. And conceptually, what's going to happen is when process A is running, you know, all this information is on the CPU, and we have a copy of process B's information, and the context switch is going to swap that copy onto the CPU and save process A's information elsewhere. Now, if you were looking at how we handled exceptions earlier, you might realize, wait, that trap frame thing you talk about, this is what that is. This is exactly the information that's in the trap frame, essentially, is that information. So we've already seen most of how we save the context, that the trap frame is most of this information. It's all the registers saved, and we already saw, you know, where we run the code that does that, we do it when any exception happens, we save those registers, and this is in fact how XV6 is going to ensure that we can save a context for later. Now, XV6 does something a bit peculiar in how it handles its context switches. So I mentioned that we save the registers when we have an exception. So what happens when we start running another program? What I showed you before is that, well, if we return from the trap function, we end up, you know, going back to the same program. And I also mentioned that we had a different kernel stack for each thread, for each process. So when we do a context switch in XV6, we're going to save the user stuff in when the exception happens, but we're going to have stuff on a kernel stack that's for the current process. And we want to have a different kernel stack for another process. So we're going to actually switch between kernel stacks and save the kernel register. So for example, if we're in the middle of a system call and we have to wait, the information about that system call that's in the kernel is going to be on the kernel stack. And we're going to, you know, keep it there, and we're going to use another kernel stack while we're waiting for the system call to finish. Then we're going to change back. And the function which actually changes between different kernel states is this switch function, which is named without an I because with an I it's a reserved word. And we'll talk about how that works next time. So there's a good question here. Why don't we just have one kernel stack? So another option would have been that we would just have one kernel stack. And when we want to switch from A to B, we'd instead of keeping things about A on the stack, we'd keep them elsewhere. And we'd like make a function call to run B instead. That is a valid design. The disadvantage of that is that it makes writing something like a read system call less convenient. So in this design, our read system call can call a function which says do something else for a while and have local variables that store information about the read we're waiting for. And that's what we can do in this design. In the design where we have a centralized stack, we have to store the information about the active read somewhere else in order to handle that. And there's another question. How are the multiple kernel stacks stored in physical memory? So we're going to talk about how memory allocation works much later in the semester when we talk about virtual memory. But basically, as part of starting a process, the kernel chooses an address for the stack, the same sort of way it allocates space to load a file from disk into memory. Does that answer that question? Other questions? So as a reminder, there is a quiz that will be due by next Tuesday. And otherwise, I will sign off here.